Greetings, and welcome to Baron's Crypt, show number 278 with your host. It is I, Baron Craze, the horror historian. Tonight's show will be all about Alfred Hitchcock, Psycho, 1960. I know for many, you probably trying to wonder, how can I discuss this movie in any more detail? Oh, please, I haven't even begun to scratch the surface of how deep I can go into this movie. Twice during it, though, I almost gave away the major secret to the film. I will make sure not to do that again. This film was shown before an audience of cinema fans at the Haddonfield High School in Haddonfield, New Jersey. The particular movie, Psycho, covers multiple areas: psychologically, sociology, criminology, and of course, some underlying theology. The class was fantastic. It's rare when you get to have 15 people in a room, all with interesting views of the movie, some who had never seen it, which was shocking. I thought by now everybody has seen this movie, but no, there were people who honestly said they had not seen it, or they had seen just a little bit here and a little snip there. You know, they never watched the whole film through. So they were not only looking forward to seeing the film, they were looking forward to discussing the movie. And I cherish that. The students were so spot on with their viewpoints. Their questions were really intriguing. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So with that being said, let's get this thing going. Again, you can check out the horrortimes.com page, scrolling down to podcasts. Find the Baron's Crypt, again, show 278, and you'll find a script to follow along with videos and pictures of so many things. But otherwise, hey, let's get started, shall we? Before we get into the actual introduction of the class that took place, I want to state that the show tonight is dedicated to the passing of a student whose name was Jim. He was a fan of Hitchcock, and his favorite movie was Psycho. He was so amped up for the class, it was incredible. So much that once the film was over, and I had gone through the entire answering everybody's questions and giving a lot of information about the movie, he stayed along with another student named Mike. Close to 10 o'clock is when we left there. He had a ton of questions. And sadly, the mics had already been turned off and all that had ended. So there's no actual recording of what we discussed and his enthusiasm that he had, all that expression. We found out about a week or two after that he had suffered a sudden heart attack and passed on. So I just want to dedicate the show to him and also to everyone who thoroughly enjoys Hitchcock movies. This has been a big thrill for me. We have a lot of these still to go through. So we're going to be producing these shows throughout the summer. And in fact, also just to note it, that this particular class is having a summer session honoring the golden year in Hollywood from 1939. Now, a lot of people go, what was so golden about it? Well, let's see. It sold the most tickets ever, and it had about 365 films made in 1 year. I will be going there probably two times for two classes. One shall be on The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes with Basil Rathbone, and then the class closes out with a Hitchcock special called Jamaica Inn. So you can look forward to me talking about those two shows also. So I just wanted to give you that heads up. Hopefully you follow along with our script, and we will be doing another transcription of this. I do want to note this also. Our person who does these sort of things, listens to the show, types everything down, well, she's a little backed up on a few other projects. So this is just falling into the queue for her, and she'll get it done. It's just a matter of there's only so many she can do at a time. So just to note that. But otherwise, if you follow along at the hardtimes.com page, you're going to be set with a script. It's going to have videos, other information. And again, it works just like the Vertigo show. We have our intro that we did for the class. You can follow along with some of the things I bring up there. And then you would have the closeout, where I am now discussing the movie in more detail. It is quite interesting to find that some people, and when you listen to the intro, when I ask that question, you know, pretty much everybody's seen this movie. It's shocking always to find out a lot of people hadn't seen the movie, hadn't seen it all the way through. Some had gotten a little spooked from it or other things that happened and never watched the entire movie. So this was a great thrill. You'll be able to hear a lot. Do want to mention, again, this is a live recording. You'll be able to tell that because it was allergy season and so many people in the room are clearing the throats, little coughs, things like this. I know it may be annoying. That's why we're going to have that transcription of the show done. And that way you can be able to read along and listen to the show again. And hopefully that will kind of clear up a couple of things that are happening. Of course, with any transcription, I do want to note it, that it can only go off the best of the audio we have. So there might be times where you'll see something in the transcription that's going to note that, you know, we take it our best guess at something, or it was completely, we couldn't hear what the person said. That does happen. The room is not built with multiple mics. It was not built for, I think, recordings of lectures. So these things are a bit hard to do. But otherwise, hey, I hope you all enjoy this in particular show. And I know you're going to say, Baron, you're doing it again. You're doing Psycho again. I said, yeah, and let's face it, I'm the expert on this movie, so I might as well do this all the time. All right? So, hey, enjoy this segment.
First, quick question. Everybody's seen this movie, right? This is a classic movie, and you all pretty much know about the film. So I just want to start with, why does Hitchcock make Psycho? Anybody got the answer? Come on, someone's got it.
No.
Because he couldn't make the birds unless he made Psycho.
No, I don't know.
Okay, 1959. Hitchcock has just made North by Northwest.
Good.
All right? And yes, and of course, we're not watching that movie. not good back there. I'll follow my complaint personally later.
A lot of static tonight.
Anyway, so he's made this movie. Now he's in the last film of his contract with Paramount. So Paramount comes to him and says, okay, we got the next film picked out from Ian Fleming. He's got this series called James Bond. We want you to Dr. No with Sean Connery. And he goes, no. I just made that movie. It's called North by Northwest. Mm. It's got action sequences and everything else that the James Bond movie has in it. So, no. Well, Paramount's not very happy. And they just tell him, well, we'll discuss this later. He goes back to his office. His staff is very loyal to him. They've already picked out a whole bunch of romance for thrillers and things like this. And he's not really interested. So he decides, I've had enough today. I'm just tired of all the Star Wars out there wanting what they want. I'm tired of the Hollywood brass and everything. So he decides to leave. He's going to go home. He wants to see his agent, his wife, and his dogs, his children now, and he just wants to be left alone. So he tells his driver, hey, take the scenic way home. In Hitchcock's world, Hitchcock is a gawker. He likes to people watch. That's what makes him happy. So he takes the leisure trying to drive down the strip in Hollywood. Hitchcock sees an ambulance parked on the side and a bunch of people. And he's trying to figure out what this is. Tells the driver, go around the block, nice and slow, slow pan. Of course, direct, you know, always, right? goes around, can't figure it out, hasn't stopped, but goes all the way back around, looking at this group of people, trying to figure out what is going on. Why is everybody staring? He looks up at Rogers Theater, sees a marquee. It's got three lines. Hitchcock has a little word that's very important to him. I'll let you all try to just do it. It's a very small word, big impact. The lines on the marquee say, House on Haunted Hill. That's a 1959 B. Schlock movie. Starred Vincent Price, and is directed by William Castle. William Castle is a director, a producer, a writer, and a hell of a marketer. He would actually go on to do a couple other B movies and then hit it big, producing Rosemary's Baby. He wanted to direct it. The studio said, no, you can produce it, but you can't do anything else. The way William Castle makes a movie, it was very easy. See, he put his house up in hot, if you would, get the money from the bank, make the movie, pay back the loan, and keep a little extra left over. Sounds kind of familiar for this film, doesn't it? The third line says, the master of suspense and horror. Hitchcock orders his driver to take him back to the studio immediately. The little word is ego. In the biz, everybody's got an ego. Hitch is huge. This man has just said he's the master of suspense. No, he can't handle it. This is Hitchcock's 47th picture. He's the master. He finds out who William Castle is. He understands what horror is. He goes, what if a talented director made the movie, makes a horror film, tells his people in his room, little office, I want a nasty, grisly, ghastly horror film. Is there any book like this? Yes. Just came out. Robert Bloch, Psycho. It's based off of Ed Gein. Ed Gein was such a nice person. You would like him. He would eat food out of half-eaten skulls. He was a little far past the transvestite stage. He just liked to wear women's skin. That's how you get Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 74, which uses Hitchcock techniques in that film too. And that's how you get Psycho. The studio, Paramount, says, we're not going to back this film, but we'll take 40% of this tape to distribute in one theater, and it better sell out. If it doesn't, it's over. Hitchcock puts his house up, just to prove himself, $800,000. But he has to buy the book. Well, that's a $10,000 payout. But see, he's got a deal with Paramount. Paramount says, any book you acquire, we will give you $5,000 back as your literary fee. Hey, look at that. Watch's agent doesn't understand the Hollywood business of filmmaking. He screws Bloch out of money on the deal because he didn't understand it. Book is sold for basically $10,000, and now it's time to make the film. And boy, did they make a good movie. This is got everything packed into it, and Hitchcock does a lot to this movie. There's a lot of things later in the movie. I hope we are able to see shadows and some reflections. If not, I've worked very tirelessly in deconstructing every major scene in the film and building it back up so I can describe it to you all in very visual stages. I've even printed out two pictures that will show certain things to you so you can see what I'm talking about to help you out. Because, gee, I don't know, we could get the vertigo thing and where I had to describe what's happening in every scene. So, and I can do it. Go ahead. Why is it made in black and white? Very simple. Besides that, it's 1960. There's no way he can show blood on the screen. There's no way it's going to happen if he wants to get the major theaters. The blood is done in chocolate syrup. Okay? He can't do it anyway. He knows he can't. All right? It's not going to happen. And Paramount has already said, we do not like this kind of filmmaking. We don't like ghastly kind of movies like this with all this. They call it a lot of gore. Just not really a lot of gore. Just a pure note here. In 20 years, Paramount is going to release a franchise called Friday the 13th. What happened to Noah? There's an
How far we've fallen. So, I'm sorry, from the video you said, so this is Hitler's film based on that book, or it is that book?
It's from that book. He can't put everything that book has in on the screen. He just can't. So
right.
He has.
I mean, it's a different main character. It's just they just there's
some of the characters and things do exist from the book. Yes, but what I'm getting to is certain scenes. There's just certain scenes that happen in the book that describe basically Ed Gein's home. And I'm sorry, but when I describe actually taking a bowl, half a skull, filled it in, the whole eye sockets and anything else, and begin eating out of it, that's in the book. Hitchcock already knows. Nope, can't do that scene.
Right.
The censors will kill me, and I will never get it on.
Will there be more sexual content?
There will be more sexual content, yes. But again, Hitchcock knows what he can get past.
Yes, that's what I mean.
He's only going to have some problems, but he's willing to battle the ratings board on it. The film gets released as an NR. It isn't until, I don't know, something like maybe 20 plus years later, that the film actually gets rated R. For all that time, it's an NR. That's okay, that's how the movie theaters were working then. Things were different from the movie theater, but he had to get past different rating boards. So, if you ever get a chance, read the book. It is a great read. And Hitchcock, at that time, bought all the copies. They weren't released like they are today. Even then, he was just able to ask all his friends, buy every copy of the book you can possibly put your hand on. And they did, because Hitch told them to do it. Basically, Hitch told you to do something, you do it, because that's just how the game is played. He's also noted, he did try to honestly keep the film under wraps. Hollywood Reporter and Variety got a hold of the film. They got a hold of it. No one believed it because they said, there's no way Alfred Hitchcock would make a movie like this. No way. They just figured it was a studio that's going to be releasing a movie by some other director and we're using Hitchcock's name into it just to drive up publicity. Well, so much for that. Oh, one last thing. People probably heard the story of Wimpy. The film is called Wimpy. Actually, there was a cinematographer on the production who filmed in Phoenix. His name, Rex Wimpy. They just used his name on the paperwork. He was the first guy on set. So, Wimpy is how he got his name into the world of the great horror film. Otherwise...
Because it wasn't named yet, or they were just trying to keep the name secret?
They're trying to keep the name secret, and Hitchcock wasn't on set yet. The opening shot is actually supposed to have been done in a helicopter. Too shaky. They already had that problem with To Catch a Thief. Remember that long sequence? It's kind of shaky. That's not many years back, so they haven't really fine-tuned how to film in a helicopter. Although, Hitchcock does lift that scene a little bit. If you know your B-movie sci-fi films, everyone who does that, Target Earth is a B-movie. The opening sequence, it borrows from there in different spots. So if you want to get a chance to watch something really bad, there you go. Makes you wonder about Hitch going, taking little pieces from here and there and then fine-tuning them into a nice, smooth thing. And lastly, you do know the film is staged basically for December. That's only because when they started filming the sequences in Phoenix, Christmas decorations are up. That's the only reason that's there. No other reason. No, there's not one other Christmas tree in this movie anywhere. So they just go, oh, look, there's Christmas decorations up. What do we do? Easy.
Perfect.
Just going to make sure you're going in December. There you go. That's it. So hopefully you have the other thing. We'll discuss afterwards. You can ask 100 questions. I'll have all the answers. And I still won't tell you one piece of trivial little information.
One piece of what?
Trivial information. Keeping that back for the when I review this film when it turns 100.
Oh.
I'll be 86 by then.
We can keep a secret.
That's nice. You want to watch Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz is the best.
I don't like Wizard of Oz. Why does the witch have water next to her that kills her? It's like saying Superman with kryptonite next to him. Why?
It was a conspiracy theory among the.
He's going to be 100 anniversary.
111 or
something. So, well, we got a medicine, maybe we'll be there for it.
It's one of the best movies.
Gee, you're all going to try to gang up with me to see if you're all over. Maybe. You'll have to watch the film.
Every lesson in life is in Wizard of Oz, just so you know. Every lesson you need to learn is for you. Just saying.
Well, since you really get the first time kind of seeing it, what's your thought, please?
I thought it was excellent, and I noticed there was a lot of drains, and, you know, like the toilet, and in the tub, and, you know.
Yes, a spiral of pitch of light draining away. That's why that's happening. So, of course, in this film, I mean, there's so much that's happening in the movie, it's almost hard to go through everything. I'm going to try. This movie, of course, has a lot of reflections and a lot of shadows. Very great that they actually came up and watched very closely to see the old thing, and they actually happened that way. So when we have Marion Crane, basically, in the end of the film, we have some incidental, scenes are occurring of her shadows. They're just normal. It's not until she takes the money that we have a significant shadow on the wall. Okay? And just above that shadow is a very large lake on the painting, almost stating where her future is going to lie. So we have these different elements. So the shadows start becoming a duality of the good and the bad. Now, everybody always catches that when we see her in her apartment, she's got the black undergarments on. You also notice that she then has a black pocketbook too. She has made a complete transition to evil. Now, the police officer, that's a great scene again, because he truly is giving the frame of authority that's occurring there. And all she wants to do is flee, and it's popping every red flag. The officer knows there's something going on. The car dealership, okay? Right now, that is, by the way, a BMW dealership. So if you ever wanted to kind of trace the path, you in a way could do this. That telephone pole still exists.
In Phoenix?
Yeah. There's Rosehart for Baker. That still exists. Just a little bit more updated, obviously, a little more reflective. But the dealership that exists, and you notice something at the dealership, what's one of the significant things we have? Plane. The shadow plane again. She's in the shadows. The car salesman, who's used car salesman, we all know they're like snake salesmen. He's actually in nice white. He's bright. I mean, he doesn't have anything to manipulate yet. But she's going after a cream color car. She's trying to cleanse herself. So she wants to get away from that one vehicle to the cream color. But again, she goes into the ladies' room. We got a reflection again. We're doing the duality. Now, there's a note here. When she buys that newspaper, I don't know if you noticed there, but you see the word okay. Okay, if you notice that word okay, this is basically a little theology being played here. The devil is playing here. He's stating, more or less, it's okay for you to take this ill-gotten money, because we learned that the other guy didn't report it to Uncle, which is another reason he doesn't want to get the police involved, because somebody may ask, where did you get $40,000? Because that money in today's terms is $383,000. Uncle would be really curious and like to know, where did you get that, and what are you doing? But so you have these different elements playing there. The word okay, again, is being inferred that it's okay for you to take this movie. The devil wants you to have it, wants you to play with your fantasies and your sins. What's the worst that's going to happen to you?
You're going to be normative mom.
So we have these different
scenes. Isn't that also so that we don't feel as sorry for her?
Yeah.
The audience themselves, because I was watching it and going, yeah, well, you know, I like her, but I don't like her as much. You know?
Yeah. We're trying to allude to this. So those things when she's driving, we hear a lot of the voices in her head, so to speak. Hitchcock on set is playing them so you get those facial reactions. So, well, they're being played on set. They're done kind of going through another audio cleansing and filtering so it doesn't sound like that when we hear it as the audience. We're getting to hear her thoughts. And that way, we're kind of justifying. You see the look on her face. It goes from innocent to a little cleverness back to this. So it's all over the place. Now, one of the things that you'll notice that after she's got the car, she's driving, we got the rain, you have many things happening here. The light that's penetrating onto her, this is kind of a reference to say, goodness is trying to capture her back. We're trying to show her, you've done wrong.
It's kind of like, symbolically,
yes.
Almost like she got baptized again.
Now,
so
then we have what's called a Dutch tilt angle. It's also known from German Expressionism. Hitchcock grew up with the German Expressionism. Shadows, tilt pictures, tilt angles. The tilt angle is the Bates Motel sign. It's tilted. This tells you things are not right. Things are askew. You don't want to go to this place. But she's tired, she needs to rest. So, this is that one spot she goes to.
She got lost, didn't she?
But the point is, yes, you got lost, but the sign is tilted. It's not shown to everyone as a nice straight sign. A straight sign would be properness. To us, we would recognize this is skewed. We're looking at this as that tilted angle. We see this again when we have Norman kind of with his head cocked a little weird.
Right.
Okay? That is another angle that's to represent another aspect. So again, when she...
No,
I'm listening.
Isn't that when the camera is coming up this way, like his chin?
Yes.
His eyes. That angle was so odd.
Well, again... Norman has got a lot of bird-like qualities to him, okay? So his neck is kind of like a chicken's neck. If you think about a chicken and their neck, his looks like that kind of reference to it. So he is at times a chicken, and other times he becomes the bird of prey. So there's those elements. Now, again, what we have is when he comes down the steps, he's carrying the umbrella. He doesn't put it up. It's another social awkwardness. He just can't figure out how to behave around other people. This also goes back to Anthony Perkins, the individual. Just to kind of let you understand something, a lot of the dialogue that happens in that back collar area is coming off of Anthony Perkins' actual history as a person. Now, at this stage, I don't usually get involved in the actor's life. In this case, I have to. You see, Anthony's father's name was Osgood Perkins. O.S. Good Perkins. He was an actor. They didn't get along at all. And Anthony had wished his father to die. And he did die at his age of 5. So he got his wish. He's dead. That guilt poured on top of Mr. Perkins in so much that the relationship between he and his mother, real mother, grew very tight. They got along really well. He became a true mama's boy. She really supported him in a lot of different ways. So you think about it, here he is, many years later, playing this type of character, and he's actually getting to draw off his own personal history.
His boy's best friend is his mother.
Yes, and he grew up with that. So you have all these different elements playing there. One of the key phrases is when that entire scene of Marion and Norman in that back room. If you notice prior to that, we have Norman Bates coming up to her with the food. And I have the image because it's not shown very well on the screen. I printed it out best I could. Three questions are occurring at once for Norman. We have Norman. Norman, here, in the window, we get another reflection. This is another part of Norman. This is the innocent one trying to bounce between. Then we have the shadow. The shadow is mother. Mother's watching. Mother's not happy. As he then says, let's go back to the office and eat. He makes her follow him. Then you get to the office. Wait. Let's go further back. And she falls again. And then he says, I'm not hungry. You eat. You eat like a bird. And he's sitting there. We have that huge owl just looking down with the crow in the background. And as they talk, there's Norman. He's gauging. He's trying to figure out. Norman, at this point, will never be Norman again. Mother is taking over. Mother's watching her. And they begin to have these conversations back and forth of who, you know, you should lock away your mother, you should do all these things, you know, your mother goes mad, and he goes, oh, we all go mad sometimes. It's just one of those things, you know. And he's definitely right off the deep end. And that line is used in the movie Scream that came out in 96, where the killer goes, whose name was Billy Loomis, and goes with, hey, we all go mad sometimes. And he says, that's from Norman Bates from Psycho. He just throws it out there.
Were they trying to say he had been in an institution already, the way like he described it? Like, but the way it sounded like he had been there.
It is, how should I put this? It is because of the, we learn in other sequels more about the family.
Oh, okay.
So there's a little bit of confusion of is his mother is really his mother?
Oh.
Or is there more family dynamics going on? You learn that basically in part three.
Oh, okay.
Part two and three will start to develop that way.
A lot of interesting things. I think I read this was the first time that they showed a toilet in a film.
Yes.
Movies would never show toilets.
Well, that was the problem. They each one showed a toilet, and the censor said, "No, you're not showing the toilet because it's highway offense." So they said, "No, you're not doing that." And the reason they did it is he got it in. So, well, you need to dispose of the crime that's happening. That's why we did it. And they said, "Oh, well,
we'll let it go." And they focus on things, the drain. When she goes into the house and picks up a book or a record,
the book, you notice the book does not have a title or anything.
Yes.
But did you notice her reaction to the book? It's really quick cut.
Yeah, but it comes with that.
Yeah, she
was.
She's about to open it and then
she gets distracted.
You don't know what it was.
Book to the book. You can't show it. And you couldn't tell the title. Back then, in the 60s, when you wanted to show a book of that kind of illicit material, it would be a black book, okay? It doesn't have any writing on it. So when she opens it up and she sees this quick look from her eyes, we don't know.
And the record says Erotica.
It was a classic.
Like erotica.
Yes. Yes. Again.
I thought, is that some classic? Like German opera.
You have these things happening.
It was erotica without the tea.
Yes.
But I mean that's a real classic.
Oh, is it?
Symphony number 3 by Beethoven.
There you go.
So it would be almost like saying it would be like saying that they should have easily picked
Bach.
See,
and on a G string.
He probably murdered.
Right, but I'm just saying. I mean, I'm just saying. Hey, they could have picked Bach, and the piece you would probably have picked to, for Hitch would have been Air on a G string. It plays on there, and the censors couldn't do anything about it because they go, "Oh, it is true classical music, so you have to kind of let it happen." Now, in the shower scene, which is probably the most famous scene ever, I mean, it's just right up there. We have a couple different things happening. When she first steps into the shower, and she's this way with the shower head, we see a shadow, okay? That shadow's there. But when she turns around, and she's basically fully cleansed, there's no more shadow. She's returned to the proper. Now, as she turns back, and she's getting all done, we see this huge void. This is called negative space in the framing. So she is really down in this corner. The audience knows something's going to fill that space. They don't know what, but they know something's coming. And that anticipation is Mother. Okay? And this is basically now at 70, approximately 78 seconds. That entire scene encompasses with about 54 cuts that are happening. And when this got sent to the censors, they kept saying, we see the knife penetration, we see a nipple, we see this, we see that. And he said, okay, I'll take it out. Oh,
you
good.
See a little body, but that wasn't her. That wasn't...
No, it wasn't her. It was actually a Playboy model who had no problem with nudity.
Yeah.
Didn't mind.
For a second,
whatever.
You see her body, yeah.
Just came out, yeah, whatever, that's as good as a scene, I don't care. You know, that was how that scene got put together.
Like one torso.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Squatting in the shower.
Right, and the music is playing. Now, a really big misconception, and I hate this kind of theory that's been put out there, because I can prove it's wrong on a financial basis. Many people stated that the film wasn't going well, and that Hitchcock was going to make it a little bit of an extended one for his Alfred Hitchcock Presents series. Okay? You may have heard this. There's a problem with it. The problem is, there was a Western series at the same time, Bonanza. Now, at times it was a very expensive show to put together. It cost about $110,000 in 1959/60. Do an episode of that Western. Okay?
Command.
Got that number, 110.
Or green.
How much did it cost for Psycho? $800,000 to make a movie, and you put your house up. Now, you're not going to make the movie for about $700,000 and lose your house, and your ego, and everything else. It's not going to happen. That's why I call the theory a dumb theory. Because there's nobody's going to do this. The person who was pushing that angle was Alfred Hitchcock's agent. He wanted to get paid, and he was looking at this going, the studio doesn't back you, no one thinks you can pull it off, and I can maybe get this to television people, from advertisers, maybe $400,000. Where is Hitch going to get the other $400,000 to save his house and probably his marriage? I mean, these are a lot of factors going on.
Was he in this movie?
Who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was it?
At the beginning,
yep.
He's back.
He has a cowboy hat on.
Yeah.
Is he outside the...
Yes.
At the beginning.
Yeah. Did you find him this time?
No, I didn't. I was looking for him.
That's two.
I know.
One more, we're going to have to really have a problem with you.
I was specifically looking. I figured he was going to be at the beginning, and like somewhere in the busy street, he wouldn't be noticed.
You
see,
I'm
trying
to...
Yeah, I'm trying to...
Yeah, then I thought it was the actual guy that walked into the office.
No, no, he's literally standing with his back, the cowboy hat on. Why the cowboy hat?
Right.
He probably wanted to do it. He told me that it was about 110 degrees outside.
I still remember the first time I saw it. I'm trying, you know, when everything's happening, trying to figure out what is going on. Was, you know, when the psychiatrist comes in at the end, just kind of explains
that's
the whole thing.
Well, see, now a lot of people have trouble with this.
That guy. He's somebody.
Simon Oakley. You would have maybe, if you had watched, say, Cold Shack
The Night Stalker was a TV series that was on in the early 70s. He was on that.
Yeah. His voice was very familiar.
Police officer in West Side Story. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Officer McCrumpy?
Wasn't he? Yeah. In the original West Side.
So, now we're going, okay. So that end sequence. Now, a lot of people have trouble with that, especially the modern day audiences. They don't like it. They think it's, why are you telling us all this? But again, what did I tell you? You can't look at it from your eyes of today. It's 1960. I'm sorry to tell you this, but families didn't sit around the dining room table talking about transvestites. And all of a sudden, they didn't do it. They didn't even understand it.
Killing the mother.
Right. None of that is there. So they have to explain it all. It has to be told.
Right.
In fact, the Diagnostic Mental Disorders book does not remove homosexuality and transvestite from its book until 1973, 13 years after this film. Up until that, they consider
it. Oh, the same year that everything came out. Sorry, I've been watching. Oh, the abortion thing.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden, everything was okay because of, you know.
But at that point, they have to explain it. They have to. Now, of course, the end scene we have is the really great layering of what people think is two shots. Sorry, it's three shot layering. Mother skull, for just a half a second, that pause it. That chain is the noose coming down to the neck. Okay, you just have to pause it. There's really no way for you to catch it.
He makes that look with his eyes in that last scene.
Yeah, and that's all pushed into there, so it's really great. So you have these different things. Now, just a pure note, from the Perkins family, Perkins had two sons. He had, believe it or not, was, wait, I'll get there.
Okay.
I know you want to go there. That's why I'm research.
I did my homework.
I know. I want you people to go for it. So we have Elvis Perkins.
There you go.
Elvis goes into the music industry. That's where he pretty much stays.
Good.
Then he has another son named Osgood. So it's O-Z, Good, Perkins.
Oh,
he's a writer, a director, and he got to star in Psycho 2 as a young Norman. So there's that. And I always bring this up because the poor family has had a massive tragedy in it. And that massive tragedy is with the mother. The mother had a horrific, murderous, ghastly, gruesome death.
His mother? His wife or his real mother?
His Eddie Perkins' wife.
Okay.
Osgood's mother.
Children's mother.
Yes. Had a horrific death. She died on 9/11. She was on American Flight Airlines.
She was pregnant.
No, she was on flight 11. You went into the North Tower. If you're curious, you can go to the North Pool, go to panel N-76. Her name is there.
What was her name?
Her name was Barry Berenson.
Barry?
The point is, she was vacationing in Cape Cod, and she would always go back to Los Angeles and spend the September 12th is the day that Anthony Perkins died. This is really weird how this thing happens. And she spent that day alone remembering his death. And
were they married a long time?
They were married for a while, yes. Now, just for a note, you had noted Tab Hunter. Let's just say they were friends, and Anthony, okay?
Whatever you want.
Let's just put it that way. But just to have a little fun with Tab, Tab's last film he did, by the way, it was called Dark Place. Came out in 92, July. Anthony dies in September.
The character that Tag Hunter plays in Dark Places, Perkins. Just a little weirdness in how things go together.
In life. Wait, that's his name or is it
the that's
the
character he plays.
That's the name of his character?
Perkins. Yeah, a little weirdness.
Alright, so totally ridiculous observation, but.
Sure, go ahead. Wizard of Oz hand.
I heard you mention this. Large I was keeping track. I was going to bring it up.
Private yeah. investigator comes out of his car twice from the passenger side. Yeah.
She did too.
That needs to be.
Yes, there's a reason.
Yeah.
And the reason is very simple. Hitchcock does this only before he's got his established shot. Everything's established. It's just
an
easier.
English shot?
Huh?
An English shot, so he has to get out.
Right.
It's just the way.
So the camera is in the car, because the driver's side doesn't have.
Yeah, because if you get out of the driver's side, the camera's got to pull back and reset. And again, Hitch has only got literally a really tight budget. So he has to make these shots work in a certain way. That's it. That's the only reason that those shots are set up that way.
Yeah, because when she got out of the car, she did.
Yeah, she did, but I guess it didn't look that funny when she did. It looked just funnier for
her
dad.
He slides it over and goes out.
Because, you know, her bag was on that side of the head.
The advantage, in either way you look at it, is that the cars all have the bench seat.
Right.
So there's nothing in the middle.
Right.
You just slide across. Purely to also note this, the cars that were being used were all Fords because that's the cars that Hitchcock had the contract with for his series. Mm-hmm. And just to purely put it down, Janet Leigh, her character with that Ford, mm-hmm. Basically makes a reappearance in another movie. But you know what it is? Come on. This is his question. He didn't pay attention on Hitch. So now you get the question.
No, I'm
okay. It's a horror movie.
I figured a horror movie. Can you give me a year?
No.
Okay.
I'll give you a hit. Franchise.
Wait, is it Halloween?
It's Halloween.
Okay.
Okay. Which one?
Oh, Janet
Lee's
mother.
There you go. H2O. Okay. If you watch that scene where she appears and then walks in the car, you will hear Gunnar Herriman's music. Just for a few moments, you'll hear his sound in it. And that what makes this movie so great, is that music score.
Right.
And of course, especially for the Aubrey Gas scene for his murder, when she comes out, you go to the bird's eye view, huge shot up here, you swoop down. Now, Hitch wasn't on set for the first day when they did that scene, and they botched the scene. He saw the rushes, he didn't like it, they didn't listen, he was upset. So they filmed it again, and the scene is really done in a reverse angle. So we have the music piercing through, and then we have the brass instruments coming in at the end, where we have him kind of gargling at the end of the wood. And that's all happening.
I have a question on another scene that maybe there's a silly reason for it, but maybe there's symbolism behind it. When she gets in the shower, normally when I go in the shower, I will turn the shower on, make sure it's like a good temperature,
I
and then
get in.
She went in and just is that just you, or is that like some rationale behind that, where it's just like...
That was just nuts.
I know.
That's too cold. I wasn't sure, because he's such a control freak when it comes to things, was it something you just like...
Well, first of all, that scene takes approximately 6 days to film, that entire sequence. For that very short period of time.
Yeah, but we're all sitting here thinking cold water.
I was thinking hot water.
Yeah,
I was thinking.
Do you have an old house? It's
cold. Right, and that's exactly what's happening here. Hitchcock wanted a fully functioning shower. Everything needed to work in the scene. So, literally, they had to build him a fully functioning. They had to work the water going down. We have to have this work. No, everything has to work. And yes, again, it's just a matter of the actress who's pretty much going to do this. Everybody's just going with, turn the water off. It's going to be cold. It's always cold. Everybody knows that. And she doesn't care because all she wants to do is rid herself of the sin that she has gotten there. While prior to that, we have Norman in the parlor watching. Now, what happens in that scene is that basically we, the audience, we want to see. He's so close to his eye. we want to see. Hitchcock films the movie basically in a 50 millimeter lens. It's the closest lens to the human eye. So we actually become that voyeur to watch. We want to see what's happening, what he is. When he puts the picture frame back on the wall, you get a moment. Is as he's trying to figure out what he wants to do. And why is this also happening? What are the birds that are around him? The owl is on to one side, and the pheasant is to the other. The pheasant is the more meeker one. The owl is the predatory one. He is at that moment trying to battle these demons in him. And of course, we all know this.
Why is he always, is that something like a bird?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's eating candy corn.
That's what I'm thinking, you know, he's eating like a bird.
Right, and he's doing this. Now, Hitchcock didn't have any problems with him. He actually permitted Perkins the ability just to roam and do what he did, because he understood where he needed to be. The reason was, Perkins was a Broadway actor. He understood how to walk onto a set without looking at the ground going, oh, there's my mark. You see actors nowadays will do this, they're kind of panning down, oh, there's my mark. I gotta walk to that spot. Other actors just walk out and go, and that's it, they're there. And the directors go, oh, good, he knows his spot, and we can just do whatever we want.
Was that a location, or did they build that house?
The location is all built. That's all mocked up and built, yeah. They built it from what they called a Harvey house. That was the manufacturer.
Not a Sears.
Oh, the Harvey girl?
Not a Sears house.
Yeah, it was something that they used just to mock it up and build it and do everything. Now, the big thing is that house was taken apart, if you would. And the house was on the back lot at Universal. Well, fans did not like that. And Universal had to put it all back together, including all the cabins, too, because the fan base just went nuts. And they had to do this. And they put it all back together. There are actually approximately now 3 Bates Motels in the United States that you can go to. One's in Michigan, near Hell, Michigan, to be exact. Of course, right? The other one's in Idaho, near a forest area. And I think they're building another one somewhere in like North Carolina, near Kill Devil's Hills. Just to put things in good places, I guess. So, yeah, you can go to these places and stay in a base hotel and see if anyone's spying on you.
Now,
so is it supposed to be on Route 66?
I don't think so. Who knows? Maybe they'll get there.
Oh, okay.
I'm assuming you might have seen it, but has anybody here watched Bates Motel, the TV show?
Yes.
I watched some of it, yeah.
I watched all but the last season, I think. In the first 2 seasons, it's about so Norma is still alive, and it's about them trying to fight the local government moving the major highway away. It takes place before all of this.
Oh, gosh.
I was going to say, Norman Bates is maybe 16, 17 in this.
Maybe
I want to say 6 years ago. Went on for about 5 seasons, I think.
It's like on AMC or one of those shows.
It deals with this before it's.
He's fighting to keep the family business going.
Question: the not the sheriff, the police commissioner, but the bitch out whose house they go to at the end. They're like, oh, she's been dead for 10 years.
Yeah.
The sheriff, yeah.
Yeah.
Was he
wagon train later and
wagon train after war?
That character, is that the same character as the cop they befriend in the TV show?
Do you know?
There's one guy who has very dark eyes. It looks like he has eyeliner on in the show. It's the main sheriff. Is that him, but younger?
Probably that's where they were going. If you don't say it, he knows all that.
Yeah.
Now, just a little plug here on another two aspects, make them quick here. When Norman comes back into the room number one with the mop and everything else, and he's gathering everything up, if you notice the newspaper, okay, it's folded. You notice the word new Because we're now beginning a new chapter in the storyline. This part has ended. Now Norman is going to try to cover the mother, which never works out well. So he's going to be able to do everything. Yes?
Why did she buy a Los Angeles newspaper when she was in Phoenix,
She drove to LA and she's talking
to her.
Yeah, she was looking to see if there was a notice in the paper after her.
But if it's a Los Angeles paper, would that report a crime where she was coming from? It just seemed odd that it was a Los Angeles paper.
That, or she is also looking for a way to hide the money, maybe. The envelope, now, just to note here, the envelope, you notice, is torn. Mm-hmm. When we see it on the bed, this is a representation of two things that are occurring. One thing is that you have now broken the trust between what you were supposed to do with the money and what you're now doing. And there's also this kind of Victorian age of sexual guilt. You're doing all this because of love and sex and all that, so this is being torn open. This is their subtle way of bringing this through. Remember, Hitchcock grew up in this era, so he needs to bring this out there. You also know in that kind of room of hers, you do get a shower in the back. Just to kind of, Hitchway is just playing with us, going, look, there's another shower. I've been showing you showers since Rear Window. I'd like to do this thing to you. So, you know, just have a little fun. Also, just to have a little trivia note here for everybody that's at. I was in a wedding party a few years back, and my buddy goes, oh man, I really wanted to have a wedding in Halloween. We'd all wear a costume. You could come as the Grim Reaper. I said, well, I could come back to your wedding now. And he went, no, she's not going to let it. So I said, okay. And his fiance, we're watching something on TV, and she states, okay, I've got everything picked out. I got the date. We're going for May 18th. I'm just sitting there going, that's nice, great, that's whatever, I don't care. And then she says, the color of the bridesmaid dress is done. Us guys are like, yeah, whatever. Periwinkle.
Oh, okay.
And I sit there and try to keep straight face. She went in the other room and said, why are you doing that? I said, that's Norman Bates' mother's funeral dress. And I said, May 18th, that's the day that Dial M for Murder came out. You got a horror wedding. Congratulations. He's like, great. Shut up. Don't say anything. I said, don't worry.
Not too many people would get it.
Yeah.
I know.
Harry Winkle's been around a long time.
Yeah, but most guys don't know that. It was a nice little joke to have.
My friend from college did a bride. Her wedding was on Halloween, and she came as bride for the second. They came in full bride of Frankenstein.
I have another friend who's getting married. We're going to have a zombie wedding. Oh, just a note. Hitchcock had a really nice opinion of Gavin, the actor who played Sam.
I was loved it.
He called him a woman.
He wasn't very much.
No, he wasn't.
Why were you so?
He
was like a
soldier. She loves it.
When you see Sam and Phil, you see them a lot of times in the shadows, multiple angles of shadows.
It's a natural thing.
They're mentally confused of what's going on.
They're running on together.
Right. They're pure note. I did see the remake. I had to watch it.
And I'm glad he is.
Dumbest remake possible with one of the stupidest lines in there also. When we see that Lila says, I have to go get my coat, it's just a throwaway line. You won't believe the line they use in the remake. She says, I have to get my Walkman. Your sister is missing, presumed dead, and you've got to get your Walkman? How important is this thing? And you dated the movie so greatly. So, the remake is...
Well, I mean, she doesn't really react, but she doesn't react so tragically. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Next Monday, Christ the King, 7... Yeah, what did I say? Yeah, next Monday, Christ the King, 7 o'clock, if you want to come see that movie.
Well, that must have been one of the longest after-class discussions on a film to date, tallying in about 39 minutes. So You could tell that it bounced all over the place. I try to kind of go through in the discussion in a sequence through the movie. If you're following along by looking at the script on the Hard Times under the Baron's Crypt show here in 278, in case depending on where you are listening to the show, you'll see a lot of photos through there, some video also included. We touched on a lot of things in that, and I just want to go over a few others. And I know what you're going to say, Baron, what more can you possibly tell us about this movie? We all understand you're in love with this film. This is your movie. The film that we can put you in a room and leave you there to watch this movie until the end of time, and you'll still never have enough of it. What more is there? There's a few things. A few things I'm going to keep back and hold for another time. I know what you're saying, another time? Yes. When I turn 86, if the dark, mysterious shadows in my house that haunt me don't do me in before then, basically, Psycho will be 100 years old, and I will release everything I have hidden, stored up, and know about this movie then. Or maybe I'll put it in a book. Who knows what? How we'll be reading books by then, but hey, it wouldn't be nice. Anyway, let's go over a few things. Well, we kind of briefly touched on the Arbogast murder sequence. I want to go a little bit more into it. You see, Hitchcock understood and was well aware that making abrupt changes with the camera work will invoke an emotional response, and even to a point, a bit of a physical response. So a bit of a herky-jerk. A great way to explain this is if you've ever been in a car and you say, well, Baron, we're all in cars. Yes, but some people may have been in a car, but you have not driven, right? So let's just get down to it. You fishtail suddenly, right? What happens? Your body reacts, your eyes go wide, you clench up on the wheel. Now imagine that's those sharp angles that are happening there are now happening visually on a screen, and the director is controlling the camera action. Now is making you have these abrupt reactions that are also affecting your emotional state. That's what Hitchcock loved to do in his films. And by doing that, he could also do it subtly and start to kind of manipulate you and your body's reaction. So it was always fascinating. So if we really think about when Mother, all right, murders Detective Arbogast, all right, the attack begins really overhead. I mean, we see him walking up the stairs. He's making his way up there. He doesn't know which room really to go to, except he has been told that the woman that Sam and them have seen is usually kind of visible from a front window. So he does know in a generality where he has to go in the house. Now, of course, you have to note here, he is basically breaking and entering into a house, so he is committing a crime. But don't worry, Mother's going to have a much greater way of dealing with trespassers than anybody else. So, what we have here is, yes, the audience basically sees this from an overhead shot of the detective reaching the top of the stairs. We notice that there's a door creaking open, if you would. Not really even creaking, just opening. So, we see these different factors occurring here. And what do we get? We get Mother running out to stab him. That's one way to take care of an intruder, if you think about it. There's a quick cut, if you would, to the close-up of Arbogast's face. And this is really done for a couple of reasons. The main reason for raising the camera to this overhead shot was what some would say is the bird's-eye shot, the bird's-eye view. But it's also a little bit of theology here. It's from the God's point of view. You know, God overseeing, if you would, what is occurring, what his, some would have to put down as what his children's free will is now encountering upon. Arbogast is on the hunt to recover money. He's on the hunt to find Marion. He's on this hunt. But in his pursuit of righteousness, he has committed a crime. He has invaded someone else's space. He is trespassing. He has broken into a house. I mean, the door was unlocked. Doesn't really matter. I don't see how a lot of people would justify a stranger entering into somebody's house to snoop around for evidence or for someone. It's one thing to enter a house if you're curious, you're there to see if somebody's okay. But that doesn't seem to be what is on Arbogast's brain. He wants to talk to someone. He wants to pursue Mother. And Mother is not having any of his business in her home. Not going to happen. I mean, you see how she's about sex already. She wants a strange man coming into her home, into her bedroom? Oh, no, 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 no. So we have that happening here. We also have this contrast between the long shot and the close-up shot, because we have the knife coming down on him. The knife represents the power that she is emitting here. This power of, you penetrated my home, I shall now retaliate by penetrating you. So there is that sexual play going on in there. And it's just like with the music, if you listen carefully, we have the high shot, okay? Got that high shot? Think about it. And you hear the violins. And then when it comes down to the end of the scene, really, we have the brass instruments clashing together. That moment of final, death, if you would, right there. And this is really incredible that this is all occurring. But people always seem to forget this, that Arbogast, for lack of any other understanding, is that he has broken the law. And people, I know, would say, well, wait a minute, you're going a little too far. Am I? It's one thing you start snooping around. You go to the motel, and you're asking questions and everything. And, he basically says he wants to talk to Mother and says, basically goes, well, you need a warrant and you need these things. And, he's saying this back to Norman. And you think about it. So he does know that he needs certain pieces of paper to go and do further investigations. Well, he's not a police officer. He's a detective. So to get a search warrant, he's going to have to get the police involved. And his client doesn't want the police involved because, again, they're looking for $40,000. And most likely, this $40,000 wasn't declared to Uncle, wasn't declared anywhere else. He's looking for different things, and he's not getting the police involved. He's just acting on his own instinct of, well, sure, I don't really live there, but so what? I want to talk to that person. I'm going to go in their house, and I'm going to make them talk to me. No. It wouldn't have worked then, and it definitely wouldn't work in today's society. It just wouldn't. Somebody wants to talk to you, you're inside your house. They're not the police, and they decide, oh, the hell with it. I'm going to enter anyway. I'm going to walk up your stairs. I'm going to go to the privacy of your bedroom. Yeah. Let's see how that works out for a lot of people. I don't think it works out well in anybody's game plan. It just doesn't. So this is a really, forceful moment that Hitch is putting there. He's putting that Mother is in control. Mother will defend herself, her home, her son, her property, and her privacy. So there's a lot of things that she's doing there. She doesn't want this person there. And this person believes, I can be there. But of course, when it comes to disposal of Arbogast in the end, when we had him getting rid of Marion earlier, we had Norman with half his face in black and half his face in the light. So there was this kind of split, perfect split between him and Mother. But when he gets rid of Arbogast, he's got his hands in his pockets, he's wearing black, and his face is all blackened out. Why? Because he's now completely given over to Mother. He is now what Mother wants, he does. That's just how it is. So these things are happening there. So Hitchcock, again, is playing with the psychological aspect. At the end of the discussion, I kind of mentioned about how Hitchcock wasn't really happy with the one actor. The actor, John Gavin, who plays Sam Loomis. Now, The reason was, again, he found him very much to be wooden type of actor. Not a lot of, how should I put this, just not a thrilling actor, if you would. Perhaps it was an early role for him. He did go on to work on a few of Alfred Hitchcock television shows. But if you looked at his entire credits, about 43 acting credits, it was pretty much relegated to the small screen. That's where he seemed to excel, if you would, for his career. The one thing I'm bringing this up about is that when we see Sam and Lila, well, we see them in a lot of shadows, and reflections are done in a myriad of directions. This is because they are having mental puzzlement, curiosities. So this is actually a twofold here. On one side, you have them having these all these questions, and they're always trying to figure out something, but it's like if they get a puzzle piece in their hand, they don't know what to do with it. They don't seem to be able to work very well with each other, and pieces just don't fit together. And at the same time, they're very curious. They're curious about Norman. They're curious about Mother. They're curious about Arbogast. They're just curious. They're curious of why this happened. Why did she do it? So there's all these different curiosities, and none of them are really putting together, again, because they just seem to be lacking the information that we, the audience, already know. We know what's going on. They don't. They are going to enter into this world that they know nothing about. And Norman, with Mother, is already going to be suspicious when they show up that they're on a business trip, they have no luggage. Who the hell does this? Nobody does this. This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, you have these things happening. Well, we understand the film has got to get near an ending soon. We are going to be ramping up a few different things. And Norman's world is falling apart. He can't keep his stories straight. Couldn't do it with Arbogast. He's not going to be able to do it now. These things are all happening. So we're basically having these two other characters who are already mismatched heavily have more mismatching going on. So it's just kind of interesting, if you would. Because Norman is really, if you think about it, Norman is only comfortable with the dead. The dead don't give any problems for most respects. He's stuffing birds. He's taking care of Mother. The dead are simple to work with. There's no complexity. There's nothing that can jump out that would be problematic for him. Live humans? Oh, Lord, he's got problems there. He's got all kinds of problems. He doesn't like having people question what he's doing. So he just likes everything nice and simple. And now these people are entering into his world, and none of them are being simple, handling problems. Now, it should be stated that we also see the number three in a lot of compelling ways. One, I'm not going to give it away because I've been holding on to that little secret for quite a while. Almost gave it away in the introduction of this film. Almost gave it away in the follow-up discussion. And I have now locked down my brain not to give it away now. But three does come up in another way. You see, Hitchcock was kind of like the proud father of this film, if you would, with regard to the characters of Marion and Norman, resembling a sense that he chose these, like, as I guess the best way to say, two carefully paired doves, if you would, these carefully nice birds. Each one could harm the other, but each one is guarding their own little secrets, if you would. The third one that you would have to say as a proud father is that he's in control of, really thoroughly, is his camera. It was a concept that he had, and that if you watch all his movies, you could definitely see how he would always work with his child, the camera. Basically, in his mindset and way, the camera is in total control. If you think about it, that is very true. Photographers know this, other cinematographers know it, and of course, directors know it. That one instrument is in control. it basically has a concept for him, if you would. When it moves, you move. When it stops, you stop. One fluid motion of irrational behaviors being rational on the screen. Think about that. Hitchcock did not like how films would bring in these almost rational type of mannerisms for the actors. You know, somebody dies suddenly. You didn't plan it. It's unexpected. And then you start methodically figuring out the next step. Well, people don't usually do that. They get a little irrational. They think, well, this is a good step. That's a good step. I'll do this next. And reality is, people are looking at him going, this guy's completely bonkers. What the hell is going on here? And in that situation, it's basically very good for the audience to understand what his child is doing, what he's showing them. And that is done very well. You do have to admit that Hitchcock is bringing that all to the forefront for you to enjoy. And I don't see how people can disagree with that. His child is invoking to you both physical and emotional responses so we can see them with you, but also it's working on the psychology in you, working on your mental aspects as you try to fit together little pieces here and there and what is going to happen next. And we start understanding how Norman is really under the watchful control of Mother. But if you think about it, it also relates back into theology. Want to know how? If you really know your commandments, you can figure this one out. Thou shalt honor thy mother and father. Well, there you go. He's got to honor mother. And in an indirect sense, he's honoring father, Hitchcock, by doing what he wants in the film. But if you just look at the simple aspect of mother, you have to honor mother. That's the whole entire aspect. So that's what he's doing. That's what's happening. If you look in Mother's bedroom, there's a few items in there that relate to a religious aspect. Folded hands, different statues. These aspects of that religious moment are there. But it's also in some of the paintings that are in there. I could go into in-depth levels talking about some of the artwork of Susanna and the Elders, which was painted in the 17th century and relates back to a story from the Old Testament, the Book of Daniel. But I won't go into that. Or how about Venus with a mirror? We can go down that avenue. But why do that, right? What would be the point of me giving you that sort of aspect, if you would? But, you know, these are all really great things. We should mention that on that concept of three again, that Hitchcock had three different people were hired to dub the dialogue of, Norman and Mother, if you would. All kind of their voices were then layered and mixed together. So the voice is not just one person, but all these different elements put inside of itself. And that way, it was done to confuse the audience and even the other actors as to who was speaking. So we never really got a clear indication of who exactly was Mother. It is basically been suggested that a lot of people said that Anthony Perkins' voice was used. No, there's really no direct evidence that his voice was used. What has been determined that it was a Virginia Gregg, that's G-R-E-G-G, a Jeanette Nolan, and one gentleman named Paul Jasmine was used in conjunction. Each one was separate and then all blended together. And again, you have to understand, they didn't have the blending techniques that they have today where you could put eight tracks down and blend it all together. It was a little bit more complex, so they did, in certain ways, use certain isolated words and then pick them all out. So imagine three actors, each one is reading the same line, and then taking one word or two words out of those sentences, combining it with another two. The editing on this must have been incredible. Because you have to understand, again, it's not computerized by any means. They are literally wanting to edit things. Okay, you took the film, and then for just to do the film, right, what do you got to do? You got to take a razor blade, you put it onto a little device, you had to slice that section out. And that section could have been a second. And then you're using a certain type of tape, and then you're taping the two scenes back together. The time and effort on this was incredible. But this is what would happen. Everybody would work together in getting this thing into shape, because when Hitchcock had finished the movie, it was rough. It was really rough. And people would watch the roughs, called the rushes, and they weren't good. They weren't. No one understood the movie. So it took time to start putting that all together, and he did that very well, of course. And there's a scene that happens after Marion is killed that I think one of the students, it was either Jim or it was Mike, who afterwards asked me this. He said, there's a strange shot that after she's dead, the camera kind of drifts up, like it's going up to the ceiling. I mean, why is this? There's this weird camera shot. This is because for just of a half of a second, a breath is taken by Janet Leigh. She just couldn't hold the position any longer. And somebody notes this to Hitchcock, and he goes, damn, we got to fix it. The only thing he had left to go to was this other extraneous kind of shot. This is why directors always are on set, will then say, okay, and hold for something like 5 to 10 seconds. And what they're doing is they're just stretching the footage, if you would, so in case something goes wrong in editing when they're looking at it, they can cut to something else. Some directors will even go a step further, that if they have a kill scene on a bed, they'll have their camera person kind of drift around the room and, you know, just like almost the soul was leaving the body and is drifting away, and it's like almost doing a slow turn out of the room. This is done again in case there is a problem with the scene itself. Somebody's finger moves, they take a breath, whatever. They know they can't go back and reshoot that at any time. So by doing these other lingering shots, you must have seen them in films by now, you may go with, why in the world are they doing that? It's because a lot of times they found that there was a problem. Something really insignificant, but to them, they are trying to make their perfect movie and they've got this problem. So what do you do? What do you have left to turn to? Oh, I have this box full of extra pieces for that scene. I can do all these different techniques and I can make this work. So sometimes their cinematographer person may be on a Steadicam, which is an entire device hooked to them, and they'll do a slow kind of panning. They're picking this up a little from Hitchcock. Sometimes we find in Hitchcock films, he would do these kind of slightly odd shots, an extra lingering or something. This is because Hitchcock is looking for his scene to transition him to the next spot, and he needs something because something maybe didn't go exactly the way he thought or it wanted to go on set. So what he did was he come up with this laborious way of going, okay, I know what to do. We're going to just move this camera this way, and this gets us what we want. And that works really well. So you definitely have to enjoy the things that he did there that has transcended into other filmmakers' palette and brought into their film. So Hitchcock, still to this day, influences everyone. I should mention that The Three also does appear again in the film in another way. And this deals with three different stunt doubles for Mother. So again, The Three just keep adding up in this movie constantly. So there's so many different aspects to that that it really does lead to a couple other issues that I'm not going to bring up because I'm going to hide those little secrets until another time. So you'll just have to think about what else they could be. But you got to be thinking, three, three, three. Okay, so Baron is going somewhere with all these threes, but he's not going to tell us, so we're not very happy with him right now. Oh, well, what are you going to do? Just for those who are curious, the sound of the stabbing that happens to Marion is actually a combination of two pieces of food. So that's ruined some people's dinners out there. One is a form of a melon. I'm not too sure. This is a C-A-S-A-B-A melon. And also a piece of sirloin steak. So next time you see sirloin on a menu, or someone says, hey, we're having sirloin for dinner, and you put your knife in to cut it, you can be thinking, oh, God, that's right. Baron told me once that this is the meat that was used for the stabbing of Marion, because he wanted to get the right sound for everything. In addition, I want to tell you that, of course, Psycho has influenced past cinema. I mean, the number of movies that it has inspired is endless. If we just think about the horror industry alone, there's so many movies. Black Christmas, Halloween, Scream from 1996. The latest Scream movie, I think it was Scream number 5 from 2022, excuse me. There's so many movies. It's really endless. And if we expanded that to all of cinema, the techniques, the stylization, the music, everything, it's just really, there's no end to it. It's everywhere. Martin Scorsese, if you've remember the film Raging Bull, there's a fight sequence. If you look at that fight sequence and then watch the shower stabbing scene, you can kind of see where he got a lot of his editing cuts from. They heavily mirror the shower scene, so that's always fascinating to know that. But Psycho has gone on to influence in music. It's influenced in art. There's something out there known as the collector circuit. These are people that collect a lot of movie memorabilia. When it comes to Psycho, there's not a lot to really collect because it never went that way for whatever reason. I'm not saying because of the year. It never got that way later on in life. McFarlane Toys came out with a figurine of Norman Bates dressed in the periwinkle dress that was as Mother. I actually have that figurine still in its case. So that's that item. There's other people who have bought neon that says Bates Motel and has the option of turning on the no vacancy sign. I have met people who have done models for their, believe it or not, model railroads, and they had a model of the Bates Motel with the house, and had the house elevated too. There was a model kit that was put out, it's actually been put out two separate times, and both times it sold out immediately. So it just tells you that there is a fan base for the film that really is always hungry for more. They are on the lookout for the book. The soundtrack has been released on vinyl, cassette, CD, and now digital. And there's people who have bought, obviously, the vinyl and perhaps the CD. I have. The film has been released in all types of forms of DVDs. I think it was on a laser disc at one time, which is really going back. Obviously, you know, it's been on a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K. I mean, it's endless of how much has been there. So many bands, like I said, have done some sort of reference to Psycho. Billy Joel had a song that he puts the word Psycho into and uses a little cue of the music from Bernard Herrmann. Bernard Herrmann's music, there you go again, has gone on to be in movies like Reanimator from 1985. And of course, can't forget it. How about, Friday the 13th, Paramount Studios, 1980 movie. It's got a lot of Psycho brought into that film in a lot of different ways. So yeah, there's all these elements that are there, and they're fascinating. And that's why I like to say that Hitchcock's film is still going to influence past today, past 10 years, and so forth. It is always going to be remembered, is always going to be clamored to be watched. Every time there's a anniversary, this film comes out, and people go and see it. When I say they go, I am talking about, you know, it was COVID and the film came out, and what happened? People went to see it. They had about a seat between them. They got their little blankets up there. Some people had the blanket of Psycho, which, again, has sold out. And they're sitting there, and they're watching this movie, and they're enjoying themselves. And when it was over, they're all clapping. I remember pre-COVID, I would go and see it, and people would ask questions about it. And I, of course, there I am, interjecting myself into it. So it's just a great movie. I want to thank everybody for having the time to listen to the podcast, listen to the students that are in there talking about the movie and everything else. And on our way out, we are going to be playing something here that's pretty cool as soon as I can cue it up here. So you. All right, so our closeout song, we don't have permission to play Bernard Herrmann's actual Psycho theme music. We're just not allowed to do that on the air. But what we do have is an interesting composer who did a really curious version of the Psycho theme music. And just to make sure I don't screw up his name, we asked the Google Translator for a little help to get the name right.
Joachim Horsley.
And one more time.
Joachim Horsley.
And I'm going to spell that, even though it's probably going to be on our script there. For anybody who's not following along with the script, it's J-O-A-C-H-I-M space, and then it's H-O-R-S-L-E-Y. The track is basically called Psycho Theme on Piano with Knives. Seriously, that's what it's called. We are going to be including a link to the video that he made, which is about 2 minutes and 5 seconds long, so you guys could watch it if you want to. But also that you definitely get to hear this music. It is very unique, but does show you serious skill and talent. When you watch it and just to hear it, it's incredible. Again, thanks for listening to The Baron's Crypt. Be sure to like The Baron's Crypt on Facebook, The Horror Times on Facebook. If you're curious, it's The Horror Times 666. That's what you got to look up on Facebook. Again, go to Facebook, then you're going to look up The Horror Times. That's got an S at the end of it. Then it goes 666. And there you go. You'll find it there. We have nearly 4,000 followers on that. Very happy with that. And hey, make sure you always tune in to for the Horror Times and for the Baron's Crypt. There's shows still coming up. We've still got to cover Dial M for Murder, Rope, To Catch a Thief, The Birds, Frenzy. So there's still some more out there we got to cover, and we are going to do that for the Alfred Hitchcock class that I've enjoyed speaking with and hearing their views on these films. It's been a great inspiration for me. Thank you. Night.